Come Monday morning, can you relate to any of those feelings? You feel like you spend your precious minutes trying to get ahead or stay ahead or maybe catch up? You ever feel like at times you're in the middle of a rat race, running down endless corridors, trying to find the cheese and running into dead ends along the way? Well, that's what we're going to be talking about this morning, so I encourage you to grab a Bible and turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 4. We're going to be looking at some of the more practical things in the book of Ecclesiastes that relate to the things that move us in our lives. So we got a practical message coming. Last week, I asked you guys to pray for a meeting that I was going to be involved in last week, a meeting with 26 other pastors representing about 1,000 churches in six regions of the United States coming together asking the question, is God putting together a national network of churches that would really truly commit their hearts and minds and passions and resources to go after the re-evangelization of 314 million Americans? And by the end of our time together, 26 pastors had signed the covenant that we're committing our lives to go after this country, to reach them with the gospel of Jesus Christ, and to invite the other churches in the nation to join us. And so pray for our Christ Together network that's beginning. You'll hear more about that in the future, but God's leading us in that direction. I really appreciate your prayers. They were very felt during our time together. So thank you. In the book of Ecclesiastes, thank you. Ecclesiastes chapter 4. If you don't have a Bible, we have them around the room, so feel free to jump up and grab one. This is great stuff. Let me just kind of give you an overview of the passage really quickly, and then we'll dive into the meat of it. Solomon makes four observations of how we do life, and they begin with this phrase, I looked and I saw, or I saw in verse 1. So he'll make the observation of how we do life, and then he's going to use the word better to give us a better way. So this is how we tend to do it, then there's a better way. So you'll notice like in verse 3, but better than both. So we're going to see that pattern four times. I saw this, and there's a better way of doing it. Now what Solomon identifies in this passage after his lifelong pursuit of grabbing life and getting the most out of it, trying to find meaning in all kinds of pursuits, whether pleasure, popularity, business success, achieving military conquest, amassing all kinds of money, all kinds of women, all the things he does, he's looking back on that, and in this passage, he points out four drives that drive us as people. And those drives have a tendency to be destructive if carried to extreme. And the strange part about that is every one of these four drives can make us successful, make us look good, or they can break us. They can ruin our very life. So let's look at these four drives together. The first drive is found in verses 1 through 3. And he says, again, I looked and I saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. The first drive is the drive to obtain the power to oppress people. The drive to obtain power, which is used to benefit me and oppress you. He said, again, I looked and I saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. Power was on the side of their oppressors, and they have no comforter. What he's saying is when I looked around the world, I began to understand that in this world, there tend to be two types of people, those in power and those not in power. And the ones in power have a tendency to believe that the people who are not in power have been put on this planet in order to benefit them in some way. And so to use that power to squeeze the benefits, to come in the direction of the oppressor. And he says, you know, when I looked, I didn't find anybody that would comfort them. The word comfort implies that would be someone who would take up their cause, the cause of the oppressed, and actually do something about it. And so Solomon, in his very cynical way, kind of cynical on life, after seeing all of the people that he'd seen, he says in verse 2, and I declared that the dead who have already died are happier than the living who are still alive, but better than both is he who has not yet been born, who has not seen the evil that is done under the sun. His better is a better of liberation, to be liberated from oppression. But he says, ultimately, there's really two ways to be liberated from oppression. One is to die. In other words, it's better to be dead than it is to be living in the pain that you are being used and you're not ever going to get somebody to bail you out. Nobody's going to help you. Or, better yet, to have never been born into a world where you see the pain of humanity. Now keep in mind, Solomon is simply talking about life under the sun. In the absence of the intervention of God, humanity left to itself. People who have power will often and continuously use that to take advantage of people. Now, no matter how sophisticated we become as a people, no matter how educated, we still see as we look around the world globally that people are being oppressed. From Syria to Burma, people are being oppressed. But we also have begun to discover that even in our way of life, oftentimes our way of life, benefiting from the resources and the money we have, inadvertently puts people in sweatshops and all kinds of disadvantaged positions where environmental rules that regulate our neighborhoods don't apply to other places in the world where we get our natural resources from. And most of the time we don't even think about that. We look at the price of a gallon of gas, but we don't think about what it's doing to the neighborhoods and the places in the world where people have to live with that. And we don't think about throwing out a TV and don't realize where those TVs end up and the people who end up recycling the chemicals that are in those and what that does to them. The system of the world is broken, and without supernatural intervention, it's not going to get fixed. Okay? So the only application I have on this is if you are aware that you're using your position in any way directly to oppress someone else, that's not going to be satisfactory to you. Not a satisfactory way to live. Second thing he raises, and by the way, I'm not going to try to solve all the world's problems today, so let's focus on the ones that we're going to be able to dive into. Second thing he raises is the whole issue of success. He says, look, in verse 4, he says, "And I saw that all labor and all achievements spring from man's envy of his neighbor. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind." So he says, all labor, that's all hard work, and all achievement, that's everything that we accomplish. Whether it's academic success, whether it's military success, whether it's monetary success, all labor and all that we work for comes from an internal motivation that's universal within all of us, and that is man's envy of his neighbor. Now, here's what he means by that. Whenever we see that there's something better that could be had, something higher that could be achieved, there's a part of us, kind of a competitive internal drive that kicks in, that makes us dissatisfied with where we are and motivates us to try to get something more or do something more or succeed at a greater level. I mean, how many times have you walked back from picking up your exam in school and you got a B+ on it and you were thinking it was pretty good? You know, I work kind of hard at B+. I'm kind of, you know, I'm okay with that. You sit down at your desk and you see the guy next to you has got an A-, and you're thinking, well, he's not very smart. Like, how did I get a B+ and he get an A-? Like, I can't let that guy beat me. Or, you know, you're feeling pretty good about your SAT score, and then you find out that some other kind of weird dorky kid got better than you. Like, I can't let that happen. Or all of a sudden, your cubicle mate gets moved to an office with a window. And your cube looks so dark and dismal and just kind of like a horrible environment. You're okay with your income until you find out somebody else is making more. And then your sister calls and she's all excited. And she says, guess what? My husband just surprised me with new living room furniture. And you're looking around at your 5-year-old furniture that looked good 30 seconds ago. And now you're seeing kind of all the worn spots in it where the dog scratches and gets on it and stuff. Never even thought. It wasn't a big deal, but now all of a sudden, it's a big deal. That's how life works. When we see that someone else has something that we could have, there's an internal success-oriented motivation that kind of drives us to go after that. And so, you know, just having the iPhone is not good enough, right? You have to have the one that talks to you and it carries on a conversation so you can kind of sit in the chair and, you know, carry on a conversation. So when you're all alone by yourself, you have someone to talk to, electronically programmed to answer your every wish. Like, you mean that's, some of you are going, that's what they do now? I'm going to have to get me one of those. I'm going to the Apple store this afternoon. It's Father's Day. I ought to be able to buy whatever I want to today, right? Isn't that interesting? That's what he says. Now, what he says is that that drive for success that we all tend to have, that we work hard to achieve things, that drive for success is a drive that will never in and of itself be satisfied, because if it's based on seeing, we could have more. Look at my neighbor got that. These people did that. This kid did that. That country did that. If we see those possibilities, we'll always feel like we're a little bit behind. So the drive can never be satisfied in and of itself. You will never achieve enough to say, oh, I've achieved enough. I'm sad. My heart is completely satisfied. I could not want anything else. That just doesn't happen. And so he says there's actually a better way to live. Look at what he says. He says in verse 5, he says, the fool folds his hands and ruins himself. Better one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. So here's this principle. The principle is what is better is limited success with a healthy handful of contentment. Limited success with a healthy handful of contentment. He starts off and he tells us that there are three things that we absolutely have to know if we're going to be successful and satisfied in life. The first thing we have to know is we have to know when to say go. When to say go. Notice in verse 5, he says, the fool folds his hands and ruins himself. In other words, there are people who say, well, since all success is driven by envy for my neighbor, I'm not going to try to achieve anything with my life. Give me a hammock and a big glass of iced tea, and I'm going to drop out. The fool folds his hands. I'm not going to try. I'm not going to achieve anything. I'm not going to do anything. Maybe you have one of those living under your roof. Like, why try when I can just do this all day? You know? I'm just going to drop out. He says, the fool folds his hands and ruins himself. You got to know when to say go, when to use your gifts, when to take advantage of opportunities, when to step forward and produce some hard work, when to make a difference, when to achieve something. It's okay to succeed. No place in the Bible does it ever say, if you succeed, you've sinned. The Bible does say that laziness, lack of get up and go, is a sin. Freeloading off of other people is a sin. So you got to know when to say go. But he also says you need to know when to say whoa. You need to know when to say whoa. Look what he says in verse 6. He says, better is one hand full with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. He says it's better to have one handful of success, of achievements, of accomplishments, with another handful of tranquility. In other words, when is enough enough? When is enough enough? Know when to say whoa. I don't need to keep working this hard. I don't need to keep succeeding in these ways. When is enough enough? Because the other handful, since you only have two hands, okay, the other handful, he says, should be filled with tranquility. The word tranquility is the Hebrew word which means rest, enjoyment, peace, freedom from worry, lack of stress, an openness of margin for relationships and other good things in life. In other words, everybody ought to be able to say, okay, success is fine, but there is a limit because there's a lot more to life than just succeeding. And if I never have a chance to find tranquility, peace, relaxation, freedom from worry, freedom from stress, if my life is not managed in a way that that's also a part of who I am, then I've gone too far. I need to know when to say whoa. And the last one, he says, we need to know when to say when. Okay, we need to know when to say when. We need to know when to say go, when to succeed. We know when to say whoa, when to pull back. We've done enough or we're doing enough. But we also need to know when to say when. In other words, can you define what one handful is for you? Can you define what one handful is for you? When is enough enough? When it comes to material possessions, do you know what it actually takes simply to survive? Just what you need to get by. Do you know what that is? Have you ever figured that out? Because you might have more than that, which you'd say, boy, that's sure a blessing. I can enjoy that. Or if you get to a place where in order to maintain that, you don't have any tranquility in your life, maybe that's more than one handful. Maybe you got two handfuls that you're trying to grab. Do you really need to get that extra degree? Well, for some of you, you do need to do that. Some of you, you would actually find rest in that. But for some of you, you're just doing it because you're driven. You've got to succeed. You've got to keep going. You've got to keep pushing. You've got to keep pushing ahead. This worship of achievement, you got to be able to say, when? That's enough. I've done enough. Okay? That's enough. It's okay. I'm not going to go down in history as being the one who got to the top of the heap, whatever that is, and stayed there, succeeded there. You got to know when to say when. When it comes to money, you got to know when to say when. One of the principles that I teach my kids, in fact, I taught it here in a series on margins, is really, you really need to know, first of all, what your income is. I find a lot of people don't really know. You need to know what your income is, and then you need to make a commitment to live on 80% or less of your income so that you can take 10% of your income and you can save it for the future. 10% saved. And you can take 10% of your income and you can invest it in the kingdom, give it away, and live on 80%. If you can do that over the course of your life, you're going to have tranquility. I got a call from my son in Seattle. He's got a job, first job. He's making four times what I made in my first job. I don't know how that works, but it's just life's not fair, right? I'm oppressed. You feel my tears, and there's no one here to comfort me, right? And you're saying your son is employed. That's so cool. Somebody with a job. Absolutely. So I'm happy with that, so I'm just kidding. But he called me the other day because we started out on this, 10% saved, 10% given to his church, and the other 80% to live on. He called me the other day. He said, Dad, I've been real convicted that I need to give more. How do you make a decision to give more, and who do you give more to? I said, son, I'm really proud of you for thinking that way. Well, you know why he can do that? The reason why he can do that is because all that money isn't accounted for. He set aside his 10%. He set aside for savings his 10% for giving. He's living within his 80%, but just the mentality that I can live within my 80% probably means that I can live within my 70%, right? And maybe even my 60%. Once you start thinking that way, it opens up all kinds of possibilities for how you approach life. And so learn how to be content with your success, limited success with contentment. That's very convicting. This next one is convicting too. Sorry about that. Solomon writes it, so we just teach it. Oh, talking about success, let me share one thing with you. This was really interesting. In an on-air commentary, back last year, most of you guys from Cowboy days remember Jimmy Johnson, the Cowboy coach that won two championships with the Cowboys back like a history ago when they had a really good team. Anyway, some of you might even remember that he had a 52-9 record. 52-9 when he coached for the University of Miami. Kind of like what the Longhorns used to do, you know, a couple years ago. Anyway, he was talking on TV. It was this really weird commentary. He's talking about how people are so hard on coaches, and just because a coach loses a couple of games, don't get so upset with them. And, you know, he knows the pressure of what it's like to be coaching and what it's like to win and what it's like to lose and all that kind of stuff. And in the middle of this speech that it's obvious he's reading off the teleprompters, all of a sudden he slows down. And for a guy whose hair is always perfect, and he's always in control, you start to see emotion sweeping over his face. And here's what he says. He says, "I used to believe the best years of my life were when we were dominating college football at the University of Miami. Then, during my last season with the Dolphins, my mother passed away. I looked down on her and realized how little time I had spent with my family in nearly 40 years of coaching." And he just paused. And then he went on to say, "I can honestly say I'm closer to my family today and happier now than at any time winning those championships. Know when to say when. Success is great. It's limited." Okay, next one, verse 7. "Again, I saw something meaningless under the sun. There was a man all alone. He had neither son or brother. There was no end to his toil, yet his eyes were not content with his wealth. For whom am I toiling, he asked? Why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? This too is meaningless, a miserable business." What we have here is this drive to pile up more stuff. The last one was success in whatever area, achievement. This is actually the accumulation of money and wealth. And here's what this guy says. Now, I don't know if this guy's a friend of Solomon's or who this guy is, but he observes this guy. The guy doesn't have a brother. He doesn't have a son, so he has no heirs to pass the money to. And it says he spends his time just working and toiling and slaving away. And the reason why he's doing that, notice in verse 7, the last part of the verse, he says there's no end to his toil, yet his eyes were not content with his wealth. Here's the problem. The problem is that wealth has a short fuse of satisfaction and then a period of dissatisfaction. So some of you will remember when you bought your first Pinto or Vega. And, you know, to that, at that moment in time, it was like, this is the most amazing car. But then once you got in it, you realized, like, there were other cars as well. And so then, you know, you saw your basic Chevelle and you thought, well, if I could just have one of those. And then you got your basic Chevelle, and then you started realizing, well, you know, there's actually these F-150s, and man, if I could just have a truck. And so then you got into your truck, and then all of a sudden you realized, like, actually there's this Escalade. Like, when you were buying that Pinto, never even thought about the Escalade. But no matter how much you get, you always realize that when you get that, there's actually something more. And the eyes are so excited about the acquisition of the toy until you get it, and then your eyes start wandering for something else. And so if you chase that, you will never be happy. It'll never satisfy you. And what he says is, really, the problem is acquiring and maintaining wealth is a full-time job. Like, it takes all of his time. He's spending all of his time doing that. The flip side of that is relationships require time too. So when your acquisition of things outstrips your time and your resources to give, then relationships take a back seat. That's why he says in the next verse, two are better than one. What's better than piling up wealth? Building relationships is better. Two are better than one because they have a good return for their work. If one falls down, his friend can help him up. But pity the man who falls and has no one to help him up. Last week, in the Division III Ohio High School State Track Meet, Megan Vogel appeared on the national stage, not for winning a race, but for losing it. I want you to see her story.
Megan Vogel had just run the race of her life.
Just to be able to achieve something that you've worked all your life for, it's a really good feeling, and you can't really put it into words.
She was the 1,600-meter state champion, the first girl from West Liberty, Salem, to win a track title in more than 20 years. But what people there that day will remember won't be her win, but the race in which she finished last.
It was really emotional, and people came up to us in tears, just really moved by what Megan had done.
You see, after her victory, Megan still had the 3,200 meters to run, but her emotionally draining win had taken its toll. She was just trying to finish the race when it happened.
I was coming around the turn, and it was probably, I had about 100 meters left, and she was probably about 50 meters in front of me, maybe a little bit more, a little bit less, and I saw her fall.
What Megan did next not only lifted up another runner, but an entire stadium.
I just kind of didn't think twice about it. I knew I was just going to go pick her up and help her out. I mean, if you work to get to the point of the state meet, then you deserve to finish no matter who you are, and I was going to make that happen for her no matter what.
The official results showed that Arden McMath from Arlington High School finished 14th in the 3,200 meters, Megan Vogel 15th. But in reality, they finished together.
Distance runners kind of have this camaraderie that they build, I mean, from running against each other for, I mean, sometimes 6 years, and you just kind of get this relationship with them and you become a family. And
after the race, the two shared something else.
So we actually ended up in the same training room together, in this bed side by side, getting fluids and trying to get rehydrated. So
Megan wears her winner's medal with pride, but she doesn't need it to show she's a champion.
As a parent, you know, it just, you know, she just knocked my socks off, and what she did, and you know, her compassion, and the fact that she was just so humble about it and didn't really think it was that big of a deal is just really impressed me.
Because sometimes it's not where you finish, but how you finish. On Megan's shirt is a slogan: part speed, part stamina, all heart. It perfectly sums up the girl who found victory while finishing last.
I knew that any girl on that field would do the same for me, so I was going to do that for Arden.
That good? The commentator made a statement. He said, sometimes it's not where you finish, it's how you finish. And I would say that's almost true. Let me just rephrase it. Let me just say, it's always how you finish. It's always how you finish. And sometimes where you finish has a significance in that. But how you finish is always the biggest issue when it comes to life. You see, nobody's ever going to remember that she won the 1600. Nobody's ever going to remember that. That 10 years from now, hopefully she's not hanging on to that. But she made a lifelong impact on a group of people and on her own self by what she did. See, I think somehow some of us have this idea that at the end of time, God's going to spend a couple millennia just skywriting the most wealthy people in the sky. And that we'll spend a couple millennia trying to figure out, you know, were we in the top 1 billion, 2 billion that ever lived? Did we actually make the God 500 list of the most wealthy people or whatever? Like, that's not going to matter to anybody. It's not going to matter to anybody. Really, the life that limits its relational connectivity in order to acquire things that rot is an unwise life. And so we get this beautiful picture. He says, two are better than one. They have a good return for their work. When two people work together, they get more done, not just in projects, but in life. If one falls down, his friend can help him up, but pity the man who falls and has no one to help him up. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm, but how will one keep warm alone? And then, though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. Some of us believe We really believe that life in the American system is fixed. And we have very little control over how much it costs, what we have to do with our time, how we have to approach things. And the very wise people in the world recognize that just because everybody in your neighborhood is doing it one way doesn't mean it's right and doesn't mean it's what you want to do. Ask yourself the question, am I building more deeply into people? Are my relationships growing? And do I have time for that in the way I've structured my life? Better. Two is better than one. One final thing, he says, in wrapping this up. Verse 13, he says, better, so he starts with the better this time first, better a poor but wise youth than an old but foolish king who no longer knows how to take warning. This is a really interesting story. The youth may have come from prison to the kingship, or he may have been born in poverty within his kingdom. I saw that all who lived and walked under the sun followed the youth, the king's successor. There was no end to all the people who were before them, but those who came later were not pleased with a successor. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Solomon, what are you hitting on here? What he's hitting on here is this drive that we find the pull of popularity, the pull of crowd approval. You see, he says, I'm telling you the story about a king who, when he became popular, he ascended to the throne. He no longer listened to anybody. Didn't exercise any wisdom, no longer would listen, and guess what? He became unpopular. At the same time, there's another youth coming from a kind of a spurious background, but he listens to people. He's exercising wisdom. The people love him. He becomes the king. He becomes popular, and guess what he does? He's got popularity. Why do I need to listen to anybody? And then the people coming after him are crying, cut his head off. Get rid of him too. What Solomon is pointing out here is that the allure of popularity is very fickle because the crowd will change its mind. Last year, on the People magazine, top 100 most influential performers in the United States, the band U2 was number four. U2 was number four. This year, they didn't make the list. Last year, number four. This year, they didn't make the list. And you're going to be popular this year. Next year, you might not make the list. You might not make the list. So what does he say is better? He starts out in verse 13. He says, better wisdom. Wisdom. A life that's not dedicated to crowd approval. A life that's dedicated to wisdom. A number of years ago, when I was putting together the Rethinking Womanhood study, I came across a book by a Cornell sociologist called The Body Project, An Intimate History of American Girls. Now, the only reason why I would ever want to read this book, because I was working on a woman's study, but it was fascinating. The sociologist went back to the late 1800s and read the diaries of American girls to see what they were thinking about. And then came into the 1990s and read the diaries of American girls in the 90s to see how things had changed. And guess what had changed? The main thing, she calls it the body project. Women, girls working on their one lifelong project, which is their body. Lifelong project, that's what she concludes. Listen to what somebody said as he wrote it up. Kind of wrote up a summary of the book. Said the psychic life of adolescent girls has undergone a dramatic and detrimental change in the past century, especially in terms of their self-worth. This is the conclusion of Cornell University social historian has reached on the basis of interviews with girls and the analysis of diaries written by girls. She found that girls in the past used to have rich inner lives. They were interested in intellectual and creative activities, books, the arts, and spirituality. An 1890s teen typically filled her diary with accounts of nature walks to collect botany specimens and long talks with women teachers. Nowadays, those interests are overshadowed by the obsession with boys and how to get their attention. It's popularity. This fixation on beauty grooming and body image leaves girls with an insidious and overwhelming feeling of low self-esteem, which the researcher links to increased problems with anorexia, behavioral difficulties, and STDs. I mean, after all, if you're going to spend your life on your body, you're certainly going to need at some point in time or want to show it off or use it, right? Like if that's what you're gonna have to do that, right? Or otherwise, why put all this time and energy into it? And just the whole idea that the cult of youth is popularity today. It's popularity. It's getting my YouTube video that I made to get the number of hits or get tweeted about the most or kind of win the prize along the way. And there's always been an element of that in human society. Solomon even talks about that. Better a life of wisdom. Living a life of wisdom. Let me kind of pull this all together. As we think about these four drives, the drive of power that leads to oppression, the drive of success that leads to dissatisfaction, the drive of piling up wealth that breaks down relationships, the drive for popularity which causes us to compromise wisdom. The ultimate example of somebody who really understood how to live life is none other than our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. For example, when you look at the life of Jesus Christ, what did he do? He didn't come to oppress people, even though he was God, Lord, the King. He came to liberate people. In fact, Jesus Christ said, I came to preach a message of liberation, to free the captives, to free people who were bound up with sickness and disease, people who were bound up by satanic attack, and liberate them to have a relationship with God. He came to preach that message. In addition to that, he didn't hang on to his success or his wealth. In fact, he gave that up. Philippians chapter 2 tells us that he didn't grasp those things. He let those things go. He became a servant to serve people. And when it came to the ultimate popularity test, what did the crowd say? Oh no, we don't want Jesus. Give us Barabbas. He lost a popularity contest with a common criminal. And he went to the cross and died. And yet today, Jesus Christ is the significant person in history. He's made the greatest impact in history. His name is known globally. How did that happen? Because he followed the wisdom of God in how he lived his life. And God, through the power of the resurrection, raised Jesus, exalted him to the highest place, gave him a name that is above all names, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of the Father. And Peter tells us the same thing in 1 Peter chapter 5. He says, listen, he says, humble yourselves. Humble yourselves before God. In other words, submit yourself to God's ways. Live according to his principles. He says, humble yourselves before God, and he will exalt you at the proper time. You don't need to prove to the world that you have power. You don't need to prove to the world that you are successful. You don't need to prove to the world or even to yourself that you can get it and have more than everybody else. And you certainly don't need to prove to the world that you've got all of their attention. None of those things will give you ultimate life. Follow the example of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, because that is where you're going to find life. As we conclude our service today, I'm just going to invite the men and women of our prayer team and our elders to make their way to the front at this time. And they're here. They would love to have a chance to talk or pray with you about any of these issues. It would be a shame for you to hear the Holy Spirit speaking to you about an area where you need to make some adjustments or where you need to reconnect with God, and you just kind of pass this off and move on into the rest of your day. So these people will be here. Love to have a chance to talk or pray with you. I'd love to meet you if you're a guest or visitor. I'll be in the Connection Center out the doors and up the back stairs to the right. Let's stand for our benediction, and one of our elders, Joe Davis, is going to lead us in our benediction. Joe.